upholding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite.
We've signed a climate convention on the importance of economic instruments and free markets. We're included in this mammoth Agenda 21 document and the Rio Declaration. Now, let me be clear on one fundamental point. The United States fully intends to be the world's preeminent leader in protecting the global environment.
Coming up, Technocracy News. And greetings from Technocracy News and Trends. I am Patrick Wood, the editor of Technocracy News and Trends. And today is a very special broadcast to give to you. I gave a major presentation to a group over the weekend, Doctors for Disaster Preparedness in Tucson, Arizona. This is the 37th year that they've had a convention in different places, sometimes in Arizona, sometimes elsewhere. But it was a prestigious group of doctors from all around the country, as well as some other interested citizens. And most of the presentations this particular time were given by people who had PhDs in one science or another and were extremely well-educated. And I was invited to give a presentation on technocracy. I'm going to share that presentation with you today. And the reason I'm doing so is that I designed this particular presentation to be heard by people who maybe haven't heard anything about technocracy before. And so I paid special attention to presenting the entire topic in a very succinct and precise way. And the presentation ended up to be about 43 minutes long. I'm going to present it to you now. And my hope is that you will use this as an item that can be shared with people that you know that have never heard of technocracy, or perhaps they're skeptics and they just don't believe that scientific dictatorship is possible. And that was the topic of my presentation, by the way, The Road to Scientific Dictatorship. So in this spirit, I'm going to give you the entire presentation. It's up to you to take it and share it. Maybe invite some people over to your living room and play it for them there. Take notes. Discuss it. I expect also in time that I'll put this to video, perhaps, and put up the slides as well that I used during the presentation. But for now, this medium is the best way to get this word out. So please do take a minute to share with people that you know and hang on to this link. In the future, you may run across more people, and I hope you do. But we as Americans must simply spread the word on technocracy and educate people as to what it is, and hopefully create enough alarm in them to where they will want to take action and do something about it. So here you are. I love technology. I love science. I love engineering. I even made my living from advanced computer technology for a number of years during the 1980s and 90s, and I have the utmost respect for any scientist, engineer, or technologist, but with a couple of important conditions. Number one, that they are honest practitioners and do not falsify their craft. Number two, that they are dedicated to the service of mankind and not to its control or harm. The philosophical father of scientism, transhumanism, and technocracy was a French philosopher by the name of Henri de Saint-Simon, who lived between 1760 and 1825. Most of today's troubles can be traced back to a single statement that he made back then. Quote, "A scientist, my dear friends, is a man who foresees. It is because science provides the means to predict that it is useful, and the scientists are superior to all other men." Close quote. Well, this is a false notion. First, no one can predict the future. And second, even our Constitution says that all men are created equal, and it doesn't even hint that some are created more equal than others. A modern scholar wrote, "Central to scientism is the grabbing of nearly the entire territory of what were once considered questions that properly belonged to philosophy. Scientism takes science to be not only better than philosophy at answering such questions, but the only means of answering them." Another scholar wrote, "With scientism, you will regularly hear explanations that rely on words like merely, only, simply, or nothing more than, Scientism restricts human inquiry. Once you accept that science is the only source of human knowledge, you have adopted a philosophical position that cannot be verified or falsified by science itself. It is, in a word, unscientific. Indeed, the introduction of scientism into various scientific fields has created the widespread practice of what is known today as pseudoscience. To many, it has become a religion with an intolerant belief system that seeks to punish deniers and ignore any facts to the contrary. Thus, when science declares that it and it alone can determine the nature of reality and what must be done about it, I take great exception, and I expect that most, if not all of you, feel exactly the same way. Having clarified that, let me state that I believe technocracy represents the greatest threat to humanity that we have faced since the cruel feudalism of the Dark Ages. Let me give you a brief sketch of what it is, where it came from, and how it has managed to permeate every level of every society and every nation on Earth. First, I'll take you back to 1932, when a group of esteemed scientists and engineers at Columbia University set about the task of saving the world from the Great Depression. They wrongly believed that capitalism was dead and that rigor mortis was setting in, so they set to work to create a brand new economic system designed by them from the ground up to replace capitalism and free enterprise completely. It was the first time in the history of the world that anyone ever attempted to design a brand new economic system from scratch. The new system was called technocracy. They completely discarded the price-based supply and demand model of capitalism and free enterprise that used money as its accounting system. In its place, they substituted a resource-based economic system that would use energy as its accounting system. They specified that private property and all other resources would be converted into a public trust, managed by technocrats, of course, which would be carefully allocated according to public need. They pointedly intended to control all production and all consumption by controlling the entire societal machinery with data-driven science. That is, their brand of science, of course, which by that time had already been thoroughly soaked in St. Simon's brand of scientism. Well, here is how technocracy was defined in their own official magazine in 1938. Quote, "Technocracy is the science of social engineering, the scientific operation of the entire social mechanism to produce and distribute goods and services to the entire population." End quote. Notice that they were the ones who created and developed the so-called science of social engineering, which was hardly scientific, but note the scope of its operation, the entire social mechanism, and the entire population. Even though the original technocracy group had been exiled from Columbia in late 1932, two early members went on to create Technocracy Incorporated as a membership organization based in New York. The co-founder, M. King Hubbard, was the principal author of the Technocracy Study Course that became the official guidebook for technocracy. And yes, it's that M. King Hubbard, a founding father of the modern eco-movement that dreamed up the crackpot peak oil theory called Hubbert's Peak in 1954. Listen very carefully to how Hubbert described technocracy in the study course. Quote, "Technocracy is dealing with the social phenomena in the widest sense of the word. This includes not only actions of human beings, but also everything which directly or indirectly affects their actions. Consequently, the studies of technocracy embrace practically the whole field of science and industry." Now listen carefully. "Biology, climate, natural resources, and industrial equipment all enter into the social picture." Are you getting a hint yet of where this might be going? Only 7 requirements were noted as being necessary for technocracy to achieve its goal. I'll read those now. Number 1, register on a continuous 24-hour-per-day basis the total net conversion of energy. Number 2, by means of the registration of energy converted and consumed to make possible a balanced load. Number 3, provide a continuous inventory of all production and consumption. Number 4, provide a specific registration of the type, kind, etc. of all goods and services, where produced and where used. Number 5, produce specific registration of the consumption of each individual, plus a record and description of the individual. Number 6, allow the citizen the widest latitude of choice in consuming his individual share of continental physical wealth. And lastly, number 7, distribute goods and services to every member of the population. The technology to accomplish this obviously did not exist in 1934, but Hubbard was a visionary who had already rubbed shoulders with the early IBM team that had built one of the first tabulators at Columbia. They saw the trajectory of computational technology and were confident that it would exist in time, and indeed it does today. The first two requirements specify the so-called smart grid for energy management that's being rolled out today all over the world. The next three requirements document extensive surveillance of production, consumption, and people. And the last two show who is in control of delivering consumable items to every citizen based on their fair share. Who decides what's fair? The technocrats, of course. What about our political system? Well, forget that. They wanted to dismiss all elected officials, including Congress and the president. Private property? Nope, forget that too. People can't be trusted with private property. Savings accounts? Nope. Your unused energy certificates would simply expire at the end of the allocation period. Well, technocracy increased as a movement to over 500,000 dues-paying members in North America. But then it hit a brick wall of rejection. Capitalism began to recover during World War II. The movement was banned in Canada for 2 years because the government suspected a connection with Nazi Germany in Europe. Things fizzled out after that. Attrition set in, membership shrank. The original organization of Technocracy Incorporated still exists, by the way, today, in Decaturville, Tennessee, after moving from Ferndale, Washington a few years ago. And while you might be thinking that that was the end of technocracy, there's a whole lot more to the story that you need to know. Let's fast forward to 1968 and go back to Columbia University, where all of this started. A brilliant young political science professor had just coined a new term, technotronic, and suggested that the world's endgame was a technotronic era that would be dominated by advanced technology run by a scientific elite of scientists, engineers, and technicians. In 1969, he expanded his thesis into a book called Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era. His name? Zbigniew Brzezinski. Not surprisingly, his book was a rehash of 1930s technocracy. Brzezinski's book was quickly noticed by David Rockefeller, whose family was among the richest in the world. And Rockefeller immediately saw the possibilities of a new economic system that was resource-based instead of price-based. Why? Well, first, because the handwriting was already on the wall in that day for the end of money as it had been known. Second, there is a permanent wealth in owning resources instead of holding depreciating currency. And third, the Rockefeller family had always thrived on monopolies, and what better monopoly than to own all the resources? Well, by 1972, Rockefeller had already envisioned creating a super elite multinational organization that would be tasked with the creation of this new global economic system modeled after Brzezinski's book, again, which was nothing more than warmed over technocracy from the 1930s. Rockefeller subsequently took Brzezinski to Europe to bounce his idea off his elite cronies at the annual Bilderberg meeting that year. They were so encouraged that they returned and immediately started work on the new organization, and they branded their tagline of, quote, fostering a new international economic order. They drew the initial membership from Europe, North America, and Japan. The name of this organization? The Trilateral Commission. Since the Rockefeller family had been instrumental in creating and funding the United Nations over the years, it's not surprising that in 1974, 1 year after the founding of the Trilateral Commission, the United Nations passed Resolution 3201, titled Declaration on the Establishment of a New International Economic Order. And it started out like this. Having convened a special session of the General Assembly to study for the first time the problems of raw materials and development, devoted to the consideration of the most important economic problems facing the world community, and it went on. But notice this was the first time that the UN had addressed the problems of raw materials and development, and that it was called the New International Economic Order. In January 1977, James Earl Carter was seated as president. He was a member of the Trilateral Commission. So was his vice president, Walter Mondale. Carter then appointed one-third of the U.S. members to top cabinet posts. But his very first appointment was Zbigniew Brzezinski as his national security advisor. By 1979, Brzezinski had already achieved his greatest victory of bringing China back onto the global economic stage. He promised technology and rapid development, and those companies connected to the Trilateral Commission lined up and rushed in to build infrastructure and factories in China, and they made billions of dollars on the way in. What kind of economic system did Brzezinski promote to China? Technocracy. By June 2001, Time magazine, and by the way, former editor of Time, Hedley Donovan, had been a founding member of the Trilateral Commission. Well, Time magazine nailed what happened in the intervening 20 years. Listen carefully to what Time magazine wrote. The nerds are running the show in today's China. In the 20 years since Deng Xiaoping's reforms kicked in, the composition of the Chinese leadership has shifted markedly in favor of technocrats. It's no exaggeration to describe the current regime as a technocracy. That's their words, not mine. During the 1980s, it goes on, technocracy as a concept was much talked about, especially in the context of so-called neo-authoritarianism, the principle at the heart of the Asian development model that South Korea, Singapore, and Taiwan had pursued with apparent success. The basic beliefs and assumptions of the technocrats were laid out quite plainly. Listen now. Social and economic problems were akin to engineering problems that could be understood, addressed, and eventually solved as such. The open hostility to religion that Beijing exhibits at times, most notably in its obsessive drive to stamp out the evil cult of Falun Gong, has pre-Marxist roots and has nothing to do with communism. Scientism underlies the post-Mao technocracy, and it is the orthodoxy against which all heresies are measured. Let me repeat. Scientism underlies the post-Mao technocracy, and it is the orthodoxy against which heresies are measured. Well, thank you, Dr. Brzezinski. You created a monster of technocracy that today is trying to control the entire world. They have already enslaved their own 1.4 billion citizens into a scientific dictatorship that alone is almost 20% of the entire population of the world. Furthermore, China has already exported most of its technocracy ideology and practice to the entire Asian world. And collectively, this now represents 61% of world population. Really? Right under our noses and nobody noticed? Let's backtrack now to 1983, when the United Nations convened the so-called Brundtland Commission to study ways to implement Resolution 3201 and the new International Economic Order. It was headed by Gro Harlem Brundtland, a prominent European member of the Trilateral Commission. The Brundtland Commission operated until 1987, and produced the seminal book called Our Common Future, which introduced the concept of sustainable development as a resource-based economic system with energy policy at the center. This then was recast lock, stock, and barrel into Agenda 21 in 1992 at the first Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro. And since then, the United Nations itself has widely praised Brundtland as being the singular architect of Agenda 21. Now, you've already had an earful on Agenda 21 and how it morphed into 2030 Agenda, the New Urban Agenda, the Sustainable Development Goals, biodiversity, and global warming. Suffice it to say for now, the sustainable development is the new international economic order. That is the technotronic era. That is technocracy from the 1930s. The carrier of technocracy to the whole world has become the United Nations. Let me tell you a true story. To his detractors, Dr. William Levingston was known as Devil Bill. He was actually an itinerant salesman with a phony name who created a concoction of oil and laxative and branded it as a cure for cancer. Since cancer was a dreaded and usually fatal disease, most people would buy and try almost anything for a cure. He would explain also that if his miracle cure was strong enough to beat cancer, why, it probably would take care of anything else that you had as well. When William came to a new town, he would mesmerize and trick people into buying his miracle cure. And as soon as anyone questioned his phony operation, he would ride out a whole lot faster than he had originally arrived. And William was indeed a fraud and a con artist, but somehow he always managed to escape arrest or lynching. He finally died in 1906 at the ripe old age of 95. Earlier in life, he reportedly bragged, quote, "I cheat my sons every chance I get. I want to make them sharp." However, Levingston's name itself was a fraud. His real name was William Avery Rockefeller Sr., and one of those sharp sons was John D. Rockefeller, who was soon to become the richest man in America and the grandfather of David A. Rockefeller, founder of the Trilateral Commission in 1973. Now, a good con man knows that he has to create a sense of urgency to get the mark to move in his favor. You don't give the target any time to figure out that he's being scammed. The unscrupulous tire salesman says as he looks at your tires, "I wouldn't trust those tires for the safety of my children." The shady salesman says, "The sale ends tonight and there'll never be another chance to buy at this price." Well, let me put it this way. The cannon fodder for the sustainable development scam is global warming. This was specifically chosen to drive a sense of urgency and panic into people to make them clamor for sustainable development. It's worked beautifully, too. And it continues to work today with religious fervor, telling deniers that they deserve to be punished. I'm not going to examine the climate hoax any further right now, because several people speaking here will do a great job at this. But I do want you to remember that through all this twisted plot, sustainable development is an economic system designed to completely replace capitalism and free enterprise. Let me prove this by reading a 2015 quote from the UN's former climate czar, Christiana Figueres. She said this at a European press conference, and it was recorded and accurately transcribed. She said, quote, "This is probably the most difficult task we've ever given ourselves, which is to intentionally transform the economic development model for the first time in human history. This is the first time in the history of mankind that we are setting ourselves the task of intentionally, within a defined period of time, to change the economic development model that has been reigning for at least 150 years since the Industrial Revolution. Indeed, the entire United Nations organization is stampeding all 193 member nations of the world to simultaneously throw out capitalism and free enterprise in favor of sustainable development, aka technocracy. To recap my presentation thus far, One prong of global technocracy has entered through China and exemplifies a more direct form of scientific dictatorship. The second prong is coming through the United Nations in the form of sustainable development. Nevertheless, they are one and the same and will eventually end up at the same place. Now, I want to talk a bit about the economic effects of sustainable development. Generally speaking, I will contend that wherever technocracy and capitalism meet, it creates a toxic stew that kills capitalism. The details of the so-called green economy or Green New Deal, which is now global in appeal, cannot work, will never work, and will never achieve prosperity for anyone. The original framers of technocracy knew full well that technocracy was all about benefiting themselves at our expense, other than converting us into resources that need to be controlled like we see in China. There have been plenty of people over the last 25 years who have recognized the scam and sounded the alarm. The problem has been that nobody's listened. Let me give you a couple of examples. Pratap Chatterjee and Matthias Finger, authors of The Earth Brokers in 1994, were direct participants in the UN meetings leading up to the Earth Summit held in Rio in 1992. They were environmentalists of the original order that preceded globalization, and they were deeply disappointed in the entire process and outcome. They concluded that, quote, as a result of the whole unsaid process, that's what the UN meeting was called, by the way, that stands for the United Nations Conference on Economic Development. The planet was going to be worse off as a result, not better. Here's what they wrote, quote, we argue that UNCED has boosted precisely the type of industrial development that is destructive for the environment, the planet, and its inhabitants. We see how, as a result of UNCED, the rich will get richer, the poor poorer, while more and more of the planet is destroyed in the process. Toward the end of the Earth Summit, youth representatives were allowed to give their impressions of the process and proceedings, and they selected a young lady from Kenya, Wagaki Mwangi, who worked for the International Youth Environment and Development Network in Nairobi. Her short, pointed, and shocking statement left many attendees in dead silence. And here's what she said. The summit has attempted to involve otherwise powerless people of society in the process. But by observing the process, we now know how undemocratic and untransparent the UN system is. Those of us who have watched the process have said that UNCED has failed. As youth, we beg to differ with it. Multinational corporations, the United States, Japan, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, have gotten away with what they always wanted, carving out a better and more comfortable future for themselves. UNCED has ensured increased domination by those who already have power. Worse still, it has robbed the poor of the little power they had. It has made them victims of a market economy that has thus far threatened our planet. Amidst elaborate cocktails, travailing, and partying, few negotiators realized how critical their decisions are to our generation. By failing to address such fundamental issues as militarism, regulation of transnational corporations, democratization of the international aid agencies, and inequitable terms of trade, my generation has been damned, close quote. And indeed, it has been damned. Sustainable development and technocracy promise a utopia. They promise to save the Earth. But the fact is, just the opposite is true. They are actually destroying the Earth. In the 27 years since Agenda 21, global poverty has increased, income inequality has skyrocketed, and the middle class has virtually disappeared. Cities are paralyzed with a homeless crisis that defies any technocrat solution, and concentration of wealth has consistently accumulated into the coffers of the global elite who were in on the original scam from the start and out of the hands of everyone else. The goal of both attacks, China style or sustainable development, is the same: total control over all production and consumption, total control over all economic resources, of which you and I are counted on the same level as a wheelbarrow full of dirt. Now, I want to turn my remarks toward more current events to demonstrate how the control structure is being put in place to create a scientific dictatorship of technocracy. Dr. Parag Khanna is a global scholar working out of the Yew School for Public Policy in Singapore. He is a self-confessed technocrat who reminds me, honestly, of a modern-day Zbigniew Brzezinski. The global elite love this guy, and he's already written several important books. In his book, Connectography, which details how global trade occurs between global cities, he hit the nail on the head. Quote, "We are building the global society without a global leader. Global order is no longer something that can be dictated or controlled from the top down. Globalization itself is the order." What Khanna is saying is that the system is the order. It's ruled by algorithm, by artificial intelligence, by ubiquitous surveillance of every part of society, so that the system can be automatically managed, controlled, and directed. The attitude here is pretty twisted, but let me give you an example of the mind of a technocrat. Hanhai Foxconn is the largest assembly company in the world. They're based in China. They make most of Apple's iPhones and iPads, among other things, and it employs over 1 million people and has typically been known as a sweatbox company to work for. Hanhai Chairman Cherry Zhao made this remark at the year-end meeting in 2011, responding to questions about the high rate of suicides among their workers. This was a big scandal for them at the time. He said, quote, "Hanhai has a workforce of over 1 million worldwide, and as human beings are also animals, to manage 1 million animals gives me a headache." Close quote. Well, he subsequently hired the director of the Taipei Zoo, Shen Shi-Chen, to help him learn how to control his animals so that they would stop committing suicide and embarrassing the company and its clients. With such an impersonal view of humanity, it's easy for technocrats to manage humans like a herd of animals. Push them this way, push them that way, poke them with needles, force-feed a ration diet. The technology system to accomplish this is growing up all around us and the rest of the world as well. China promises to have 600 million facial recognition cameras installed by 2020. That's one camera for every 2.3 people. In a city of over 2 million in population, this surveillance network can identify a person within minutes of pushing a button to do so. Also, China has developed a social credit system that assigns all citizens a numerical score based on their observed and personal behavior. If you don't pay a debt or a fine, or you hang out with the wrong kind of people, or post the wrong things on social media, your score goes down. If it drops too low, you're automatically excluded from routine privileges enjoyed by model citizens, like being able to rent in a nicer area, or to attend a certain school, or traveling on the high-speed transportation system. If you've been watching the development and rollout of 5G wireless technology, you might think it's just about cell phones. However, if you listen to the heads of AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile, you hear a completely different story. They are drooling over the full enablement of the so-called Internet of Things that is growing exponentially every year. The IoT is a catch-all term for all connected devices, that is, cameras, sensors, smart meters, self-driving vehicles, home security systems, financial technology, and so on. The point is to track everything that moves in real time. 5G technology is almost magical. The throughput of data is an order of magnitude greater than 4G, but the real benefit of 5G is in the quality of latency. That is, the time it takes to make a handshake with another device. Over 4G LTE, my iPhone has a ping time of about 33 milliseconds. At my office in Phoenix, I have a blazingly fast Wi-Fi router that can ping another server in 9 milliseconds. By comparison, 5G has a ping value of 1 millisecond or less. This is essentially a real-time digital connection. Verizon itself is reportedly laying 1,000 miles of fiber optic cable per month that will connect all of its 5G antennas, which will be spaced a few thousand feet apart from each other, all over every city in America. The Verizon CEO said in a speech earlier this year that, quote, 5G will usher in a fourth industrial revolution, close quote, and that it will be, quote, a quantum leap compared to 4G. The Verizon press release issued last June says this: the Internet of Things refers to the rapidly expanding collection of devices that collect, transmit, and share data via the Internet. At present, roughly 8.4 billion things make up this universe, known commonly as IoT, from cars to appliances to wearable tech. That represents a 31% increase since 2016. By 2020, some 20.4 billion devices are forecast to connect. And by 2025, that number could swell to 55 billion. As the trend suggests, anything that can connect will connect. And breakthroughs in sensor technology, software, and analytics are poised to disrupt countless industries. But the key to ensuring those connections are strong is building a network that is able to handle whatever speed, battery life, or data loads those devices require. For IoT to realize its limitless potential, 5G is critical. So said the CEO of Verizon. It's been said that data is the new oil of the 21st century. Technocrats lusted after data in the 1930s, and they lust over it today. Remember the original requirements documented in the Technocracy Study course? A continuous 24-hour-per-day registration of the total net conversion of energy, a continuous inventory of all production and consumption, register all goods and services where produced and where used, data on every person, including description and personal consumption. Well, all the points of collection are realized by the Internet of Things, and the transmission of harvested data is now made possible by 5G for the first time in the history of organized society. This is the technocrats' dream team fantasy, to be able to model in real time all functioning parts of society in order to apply their so-called, quote, science of social engineering that we mentioned earlier. Artificial intelligence algorithms need data in order to learn. In fact, AI is absolutely worthless and useless without data. And to the technocrat mind, there is no such thing as too much data. Data storage has been mastered for quite a few years now, but technology to analyze it has lagged behind. Data without analysis is as inert as the chair that you're sitting on right now. Finally, analysis capabilities are catching up and being applied to the massive storage bins of historical data already collected. And this is all fine and good, but it's not enough for technocrats just to sift through historical data. They want real-time data in order to do real-time modeling, in order to achieve real-time control over everything, including people. In 2011, then-Director of National Intelligence, Lieutenant General James Clapper, coined a new discipline called geospatial intelligence under the program name Mastering the Human Domain. The technology has been proven on the battlefield, but has quickly been adapted to the so-called smart city concept that seeks to overlay all of this technology onto human settlements. What is GeoInt? GeoInt literally maps the entire human domain and overlays it onto traditional mapping systems. By tracking the location of people in the targeted system, they quickly subdivide into naturally associated groups and networks. These could represent any group, such as friend or family networks, social groups, religious affiliations, political meetings, etc. When you observe people long enough and with enough detail, not only do their personal patterns emerge, but also their relationships to the groups to which they belong are soon observed to follow their own patterns. What GeoIN attempts to do is locate the behavioral anomalies that would warrant closer analysis. The problem is that it demands knowledge of all normal behavior patterns and thus total surveillance of all people. On the battlefield, for instance, imagine our military carefully watching a suspected enemy cell that might launch an attack. As long as normal patterns are observed, there's no alarm. But when a few of the members stray outside those patterns, it might indicate something unusual is taking place. If those outliers were then seen amassing ammunition, for instance, it would definitely set off alarm bells. Another key element of GeoINT is satellite and drone imagery. While these may not identify, of course, each person individually, they can still note broader changes taking place in the overall landscape. And coupled with on-the-ground intelligence, imagery can take on a significant meaning as well. Now, thanks to data-hungry technocrat social engineers, civilian populations all over the world are now coming under the microscope of geospatial tracking and analysis, or GeoINT. The smart city initiatives in America would be instantly regurgitated by cities if citizens understood that mastering the human domain has them playing the part of the human domain to be mastered. One prominent GeoINT pioneer is Dr. Jerome E. Dobson, Emeritus Professor of Geography at the University of Kansas, former Distinguished Research Fellow at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, and President of the American Geographical Society. Since the field of GeoINT was defined in 2011, Dobson has been considered a pioneer. However, even before GeoINT was a defined discipline, Dobson wrestled with the ethical issues of his own field of geographic information systems. In 2003, 8 years before General Clapper's declaration of GeoINT, Dobson wrote a paper with colleague Peter Fisher titled simply "Geoslavery." And here's what they wrote. Quote, "Human tracking devices, however, introduce a new potential for real-time control that extends far beyond privacy and surveillance per se. As a result, society must contemplate a new form of slavery characterized by location control. Geoslavery," he concludes, "now looms as a real, immediate, and global threat." Close quote. Society has failed to contemplate geoslavery, even though it has had ample opportunity and reason to do so, concluding that geoslavery is the, quote, "ultimate fulfillment of George Orwell's Big Brother nightmare," close quote. They note that instead of watching 20 or 30 people at a time, location-based services can monitor thousands or even millions simultaneously. Today, of course, as in China, we could raise that count into the billions. Well, if there's nothing else that you take away from this presentation, I hope it is this. There is a fifth column of actors in society, and now global society, that fully intend to conquer the world. While political drama has dominated the news cycle for so many decades now, this column has marched forward with precision that only a skilled engineer could have executed. Few people have paid any attention. Fewer still have connected the dots between all the areas that we are covering here today. If we could name Zbigniew Brzezinski as the intellectual father of modern technocracy and sustainable development, I have a feeling that he took to heart what the ancient Chinese general Sun Tzu had to say in The Art of War, which was, quote, "The skillful leader subdues the enemy's troops without any fighting. He captures their cities without laying siege to them. He overthrows their kingdom without lengthy operations in the field. With his forces intact, he will dispute the mastery of the empire, and thus, without losing a man, his triumph will be complete. This is the method of attack by stratagem. My Democrat friend Rosa Corey fully understands Agenda 21, sustainable development, and speaks forcefully against it. She has clearly seen through the scam and concludes most of her talks with this. It is the inventory and control plan for all land, all water, all minerals, all plants, all animals, all construction, all means of production, all food, all energy, all information, and all human beings in the world. Close quote. My friends, we cannot allow this to succeed. Americans rejected technocracy once in the late 1930s, and we can do it again, but not until it is understood as the existential threat to America that it is. If we lose this battle, the historical clock of liberty and freedom will be reset, pushing mankind back to a society last seen in the dark ages of feudalism. May God help us. Thank you. This concludes the presentation that was delivered to Doctors for Disaster Preparedness on Saturday, July 21, 2019, in Tucson, Arizona. I have authored two books on technocracy, both of which are critical reading for anyone who wants to understand the total scope, purpose, and outcome of technocracy. My first book was Technocracy Rising, the Trojan Horse of Global Transformation. It was published on December 29, 2014. If you proceed to Amazon and look up Technocracy Rising, you will find 138 customer reviews and a solid 5-star rating across the whole spectrum. The second book that I wrote, Technocracy, the Hard Road to World Order, was published on November 16, 2018. Thus far, it has accumulated 15 customer reviews. Again, a solid 5-star across the spectrum. Now, the reason I mention this is, if you go to those book entries on Amazon, you can read what other customers are saying about the books. I recommend this because what other people see, it's important for us to understand where they're coming from as well. People universally have said that both books have helped them connect the dots that they never saw before. This is not a conspiracy, my friends. This is the hard fact of the matter. You can also purchase my books on technocracy.news. And for those that would seek to give some books away to friends and colleagues and other activists in their local area, there's a steep discount schedule available on technocracy.news where you can buy 5 or 10 or more books at a very steep discount. At 10 books, for instance, the discount goes to 50%, which is typically what bookstores would get as their discount when they bought for wholesale. So I hope that you can take a minute to order one or both of these books and start digging in to the existential threat that I talk about in this presentation. It is real. It is here. It is now. You already know that 5G is being rolled out across our country as well as around the world. This is not a pie in the sky look at the future. This is now. It's happening today. So we may not have a lot of time left before the Internet of Things is fully enabled, perhaps a year or two or three, but we have no more 10-year blocks of time to let things work themselves out. And by and large, it's going to be up to the individual citizens that live in communities across America and in other countries across the world as well to fight back against technocracy and reject it again and send it packing back into the last century where it belongs, where it should be properly interred, than written into the history books as a distant entry. I'm Patrick Wood for Technocracy News and Trends. Have a great day. We'll be right back.